The Guardian.
Hi everybody, welcome to Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian. Barry, nice to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent news. What's the big news from Glendenning Towers?
I kind of foresaw this question coming and was racking my brains. There is literally no news from Glendenning Towers. I'm watching a lot of Morse and I'm beginning, how much Morse is too much? Because they're all sort of the same, a tranquil Oxford University college is shaken up by a brutal murder and Morse has to solve it with the help of his sidekick. Oh, well,
I hope he does solve it. Some big news from Luke is that although weeks behind, he says, I'm week behind you, Max, thankfully, but my wife and I are now to the point where we're playing your what type of egg game. It's coming into its own. I thought this would take over the nation, and it's taken its time, but slowly but surely. Thank you, Luke. And regarding France, West Germany, 1982, we got a great message from Matthew saying, I looked to see if there were any goalkeepers shorter than Jean-Luc Ettori, who had that terrible penalty shootout. And he says, Jorge Campos, he of the daft shirts, was 5'6". Looking at Mexico teams from the 90s, I wondered how he looked much taller and realised in every single photo, he is standing on a ball, the cheating little sod, he says. And I've tweeted out the picture and it's absolutely hilarious.
5'6", that's so short for a keeper, isn't it?
Short for a footballer.
Yeah, for a goalkeeper, 5'6", crikey.
Now, there's a new podcast coming out, Barry, from The Guardian about football and not including us. So it may be of high quality.
How very dare they?
Well, it might be of high quality. It's Forgotten Stories of Football. If you've read any of the long reads, Forgotten Stories of Football, they are stories that you probably don't know about but are really quite fascinating from the world of football. And they've got actors. They've got people who can read out loud properly to voice them.
I understand that they've got proper thespians in to read these stories. So I'm just wondering, did the Guardian go big budget and spring for Tom Hardy and Stephen Fry, or is it just some no mark from Hollyoaks?
The quick answer to that question is, Barry, I don't know, but I do have the trailer for episode one. So
Well, there's an easy way to find out, I suppose.
There is. Listen to the trailer for episode one right now. We'll be back with Jackie Oatley's life stories in just a second.
Welcome to Forgotten Stories of Football, a new podcast series from The Guardian. Each episode features a great story from the history of football you've probably never heard before. From the captain of France who murdered for Hitler, to the Sheffield Wednesday top scorer who acted with Charlie Chaplin, to the story of how primetime TV inspired one of the sport's most shambolic appointments with manager idol. Forgotten Stories of Football spans 100 years of sporting history from across the footballing planet. Written by some of the world's leading sports journalists, the series is narrated by leading actors. Take a listen to this clip of episode 1, Football, Farce and Fascism at the 1936 Olympics.
Britain came back only when the Poles relented and, through some overly rugged play, notably from Queen's Park's John Gardiner, who drew scorn from the crowd.
The Poles were a lively lot and gave the British defenders a harassing time,
reported The Guardian.
Gardiner annoyed the crowd by his hefty charging, and there was some booing when he bowled over God.
They meant the Polish forward Hubert Gad. So what appeared as a stupendous Nietzschean achievement is in fact the only known instance of a typo in The Guardian.
With the first episode debuting on Wednesday the 13th of May, listen out for The Guardian's Forgotten Stories of Football. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the life and times of Jackie Oatley. And for that, we need Jackie Oatley. And fortunately, she is... What room are you in there, Jackie?
I'm in the study, which happens to be right next to the wireless router, which is rather handy for
these
things.
That is excellent, yeah. And it looks like you're TV ready with a bookshelf behind you. It looks like a couple of trophies in the background as well. Are they right on the bottom shelf? What are they?
It's either the Holy Grail or a small trophy.
It's an FA Cup. Oh, that is a small trophy. I don't know what that's for. I think it might have been a wedding present from a family member, but I should really know. One is an FA Cup final programme.
Okay.
Hang on, let me just see which team. I think it was Wolverhampton Wanderers against Blackburn Rovers 1960.
Yeah.
And the other one is another programme, Molyneux. From the 1970s. And the other paraphernalia, okay, there's a bit more just stuff, admittedly.
Yeah.
But there's other Man United stuff, which is my husband's, and rugby World Cup winning stuff.
It's a much more professional get-up than either me or Barry have. So what is, Jackie, what's your first footballing memory?
First football memory would be, I think it'd be FA Cup finals in the mid-1980s when Everton were prominent at that time. None of my family were into football. My brother doesn't like football. So it would be that one match of the year that was on the television. I remember playing in the garden afterwards. But in terms of the match that got me into football, because I didn't have that usual influence around me that most people or most girls would have had around that time if they're into football. And I went to an all-girls school where football was never mentioned and you certainly weren't allowed to play. There was never a football to be seen on the whole site. So I just remember a match, can't tell you what it was, lying on the sofa one day and remember thinking, this is the sport for me. A switch flicked in my head. I was already mad into other sport. Always had been from the year dot, since I can remember, watched golf, Wimbledon, back-to-back, Olympics, the entire thing, everything, snooker, the World Snooker Championship, watched everything that was on terrestrial TV back then. And football had never really been a thing until that day. And after that, that was it. I ran to the front door one day, picked up the newspaper, instead of turning it to page 3, where I'd always go to the TV listings, I went to the back page and thought, I've got a local football team. I'll start supporting them. And it was that random.
I read that you're at your all-girls school, most of your classmates didn't really believe you liked football, but you were just pretended to be into it to try and get men.
Yes. Yeah, it's absolutely true. Because why would I, having never had a conversation about football with any of my girly pals at school, suddenly be completely obsessed with football? They must have thought that I'd been starved of any male contact, which I pretty much had been for 10 years. I went to this all-girls school in Brood and suddenly just was crazy for it. But it was almost overnight, and it was that weird that nobody had incentivized me or taken me to a game or any of the usual avenues. I just suddenly got into it, and all I wanted to do was play football on my own, doing keepy uppies, because nobody wanted to kick a ball around, or there's certainly no clubs in those days for girls. Nothing like that. No after school, no weekends, no club nearby, absolutely nothing. And so, yeah, I ripped down all my Bros posters off all my bedroom walls and underneath my dressing table glass surface, and replaced them with any footballer that was in match, shoot or 90 minutes. Initially, I didn't discriminate between teams. I just cut out people and put them everywhere and woke up looking at Tim Sherwood in a Norwich kit and Chick Charnley at St Mirren, I think it was. And yeah, it was quite random. And then my own love of my own club then took over, and it was Steve Ball and Mickey Stowell and Andy Thompson and Gary Bellamy with his tash. And that was it. I turned into a proper weirdo, and all my classmates were like, who are you, you great big loon bucket?
Do you know, that's exactly the same as me. I had every poster. It didn't matter. You know, John Ebrill, great. I'll stick it on the wall. You know, there was, I think, I don't know why. And I also had a VHS video that I just had, a blank tape. And whenever there were goals, I would press record to make what must be the shittest goals video of all time. I don't know where it is now, but that kind of obsession is strange, isn't it?
Yeah, I did that with BBC WM as well, because that was my local radio station. And so I don't know if you ever recorded your own team's updates, if they're away from home and you were a kid. And we had the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, it's a goal klaxon. And so whenever that came up, I got a shot of adrenaline, like Pavlov's dog scenario. And I was like, are they going to Oakwell? Is it Barnsley Wolves? And it wasn't. It was the Saddlers playing somewhere or other. And when it was Wolves, then I'd take off the pause button of play and record and leave that. And then I'd record Ian Winter's goal update from Oakwell. And then I'd have a compilation and listen back at the end of the day to all the updates. That was what you did back then, maybe, or maybe that's what I did. And CFAX and teletext and wishing the pages had turned quicker and that kind of thing, and pressing pause if your team had done something good.
It's really interesting that there was no sort of adult fostering your love of this. I mean, was there anybody who sort of encouraged you at all once they discovered you loved football?
No, there was no. I mean, my mum loves sport generally. She's South African, Norwegian background. My dad loves all sports, or did when he was alive, but he was more into golf and what have you. But no football. And again, my brother's still no interest now if there's a match on television. I mean, just no interest whatsoever. And no uncles or anybody, they all lived in South Africa. And no influence at all. Nobody took me to matches. There was no one to go with until I went to an all-boys school virtually when I was 15 for sixth form. And suddenly, going to Wolverhampton Grammar School, there was 600 boys and how many girls were there? Something like 16 girls. And so suddenly I had a group of lads to go to Molyneux with, and that's what I did. September 1990 was the start of it.
So did you go to that school to get men?
No, although I did snog Chris Boyce in the cricket pavilion once, and it was the most exciting thing I'd ever done. Having been to an all-girls school for 10 years, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm snogging by the cricket pavilion. It was quite a moment for me. Yeah, it's a realisation. And I remember sitting in my first class of sixth form, and it was French A-level, and I remember looking around the room. I was like, oh my God, there are boys in the room. It was just, I couldn't believe that I was sitting learning with boys. It's very strange for someone who'd barely seen a boy for 10 years.
I'm trying to imagine a classroom full of people from Wolverhampton speaking French.
How rude. My way.
Je m'appelle.
Okay, d'accord, mate. D'accord.
you alluded to like your career change. So presumably when you were at school or just after, you didn't necessarily think that broadcasting about football was a career that was open to you?
No, not at all. In 100 million gazillion years did I ever think, when I was reading Matt Shooter 90 Minutes in the back of the school bus, that ever I could ever write for one of these. Although Juliette Wills in 90 Minutes was quite inspirational, but I still didn't think, oh, I could be like Juliette Wills in 90 Minutes. It never occurred to me. I've since been in touch with her, actually. But no, it just never occurred to me. And still, we didn't really have female reporters. There was Charlotte Nicol on Five Live. But again, you know, Eleanor Oldroyd. But I didn't really ever think, and Juliette Farrington, really still didn't think I could do that. I didn't have any sort of self-confidence in that regard at all, that I could do anything useful with my life. I did a German degree, went travelling around the world for a year, came back aged 21, 22, and thought, what do I do? So I moved to London, like everyone tends to do after a summer in working in a factory in Tipton. And thought, gosh, what do I do now? Rent a flat, and fell into a job via a recruitment agency who saw that I spoke German and got me to work in intellectual property as a sales and marketing manager. And I did 4.5 years in intellectual property, watching Wolves home and away every week with the London Wolves, and then playing football every Sunday for Chiswick Ladies, as they were back then, and getting my football fix that way. And then, unfortunately, September 2000, I was playing my first game of the season for Chiswick Ladies and stretched to try to keep the ball in play, and dislocated my kneecap, ruptured all the ligaments. It was awful, awful injury, and it was just the most painful thing I've ever done in my whole life. And that was the big, big moment, sliding doors moment, if you like, when I thought, I can't stay in a job that I despise if I can't get my football fix of playing at the weekend. So I decided to completely change everything.
So do you think if you hadn't dislocated your knee, we wouldn't be having this conversation?
Yeah, that's the question. I really don't know, because I'd had a lot of bad experiences in the 10 months that I was on crutches while, waiting operations, having reconstructions. It was a horrible injury that I had, not one you could bounce back from quickly or ever really full-time, long-term. And so I had an awful time at work with a boss who was just, just made life very, very difficult. It was a horrible experience. And I thought, you know what, I've travelled around the world for a year. I know that there's a lot more to life out there. I'm going to try and do something interesting with my life. And of course, my mad, mad passion was sport and football in particular. And I used to listen to Five Live all the time in my sort of earphones, and even at matches. And I just thought, I wonder if I could work out a way of trying to do that. So I just scoured the internet and read everybody's blogs and biographies and how did they get in and how do they get in? What do they do? All these Q&A sessions and started in hospital radio doing sports reports and did evening courses in print journalism, introduction to print journalism, which I found via Floodlight magazine and WH Smith. And did another evening course I found out about in radio production via hospital radio. And after 6 months of that, I thought, right, this is definitely what I want to do. But how do I go from having a full-time job and renting a flat to working in sport, which is what so many people want to do? And I thought, I know, I'll give up my job, give up my flat. I have no income, nowhere to sleep. Slept on friends' floors for a summer and did full-time work experience. And then thought, no, I want to do this properly. And went back to university and moved up to Sheffield and did a postgrad and started in non-league football in Radio Leeds, which was just an amazing way of learning how to be a journalist, building contacts right from scratch, and just threw absolutely everything at it. I left my boyfriend, didn't see my friends at all because I couldn't see them at weekends because I was doing my non-league football roundup, and just worked extremely hard and took every opportunity and had no social life for a few years, but just threw everything at it and just waited to see what happened.
For me, like sitting here just chatting about stuff is easy. Commentating is so difficult. When you finished that first commentary, did you think, I really love this bit of it, to the point where, you know, one day I might get to Match of the Day?
Well, I really wanted to try commentary because I didn't want to be somebody who just stopped at the glass ceiling because that's what people did. You know, the lads would always do sports reports and local radio. They'd do sports bulletins and then they go and do reporting and then they automatically graduate on to commentary. And I just couldn't see for the life of me why I should stop at Match Reports just because I was a lass. There was no way that I thought I'd particularly be great at it or any good at it. I just thought, but surely you should have a go, right? I mean, that's the natural progression. So when I did that first one, it was pretty hideous experience. Really hard, probably the hardest game I've ever done for all those reasons of not knowing who the players were, not being able to see the players, of not having any prep time and what have you, all the things that you really thrive off. And but I thought, no, I've done it once and it was blinking hard, but next time I do it, surely it'll be a lot easier. And I did more. And it's like anything, isn't it? If you jump in a car and you've never driven one before, the first thing you do is, you know, try and do what you think you're supposed to do. And then the next time you've learned last time how to do it properly, and then you build on that. And it's just a case of practice and gaining confidence, which I think particularly in my case was the hardest thing. And I did some pretty awful commentaries at various stages when I was really low on confidence. And that's just something you either sink or swim, don't you? And I thought I could easily sink and go back to Match Reporting, or I could, no, I need to build up my own confidence. I need to do more of this. And that's what I carried on doing and loved doing, ended up doing more for, moved down to London, Five Live and Premier League Match Reports every week, etc., and commentating. Absolutely loved it and really got into the rhythm of it because commentary is so different to Match Reports and just talking like you and I are now. It's a rhythm thing that you need to practice to get into that rhythm.
So in 2007, you became the first woman to commentate on Match of the Day. How confident were you in your abilities when that call came?
Right. So there are two parts to this. I was confident in myself after I was asked to do it, bearing in mind that I was regular commentator on Five Live and Sports Extra. So when I was asked to do it, I thought, great, I've been asked to do a game, and what football commentator wouldn't want to do a game on Match of the Day? And initially I was given Watford, Man City, sort of game that I was expecting to be on fairly late in the day. I didn't think it'd make too many shockwaves and people might just lie on their sofa and think, oh, is that a woman doing that? Oh, and then go back to sleep. That's what I hoped, rather naively. And unfortunately, it was the Tuesday before the Saturday game that it leaked out in one of the national papers. And that's when my life became very, very difficult, in that the scrutiny just went absolutely bonkers. And cut a very long story short, and this unfortunately is the story I've told, so I'm sorry if I've bored people to death about this before, is that scrutiny of being front page of newspapers, centre page of newspapers, every columnist had an opinion. People were generally quite pleasant, but there were a couple of characters who were really quite unpleasant that made my life difficult, that turned it into a big sexism storm, that meant that, frankly, I didn't get to do the prep before the Saturday that I'd anticipated and needed to do. Because you ask anybody who's gone from radio commentary to TV commentary, it's a very, very different style. different skill, but it's a different style and it's a very different rhythm because you don't have a summariser next to you. You're not throwing to the golf and the cricket and whatever else might be going on. You're not updating scores from elsewhere. You're not saying to your summariser, oh, should that have been a red card? Suddenly you're the only one there and you're the one who's having to slightly analyse to a certain extent for the viewer, and it's a very different nuts and bolts situation as well in terms of the pre-match intro. And all those things that I'd expected to prep for, I couldn't do because my phone literally didn't stop, my emails didn't stop, and nothing stopped for a few days. And instead of switching it all off, which of course, with the benefit of hindsight, I would have switched everything off and done my prep, I didn't do that. And, you know, I showed up on the day having not eaten for 3 days or slept for three nights and just had to get through it. But hey-ho, live to fight another day.
So the media attention affected you pretty deeply.
Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't just a, hey, Match of the Day is getting its first female commentator. It turned into a sexism row, and that was the difficult thing. And just last week, I was doing a lecture for a university in Manchester for their sports directorship scheme with footballers and coaches and managers and what have you on it. And just the day before, I plucked up the courage to go into my garage and get out a very dusty canvas bag full of newspapers from that week, which I hadn't dared look at. I moved house a few times since. I haven't looked at it because it's sort of a Pandora's box of just awful feelings. You know, it brings it all back of the stress, frankly, of that week. And I opened them up and, oh my goodness, there was headlines, Motti to Totti, Motti to Hottie, Sexy Blonde 32. I was like, wow, I'll take that, but I don't remember that. It must have been a very old photo. And it was just crazy. Front page of The Guardian, is football ready for Jackie Oatley? And all this craziness. And they even had a text-in poll whether a female should be allowed to commentate on Match of the Day. I don't even remember this. I only saw it last week. And it's hilarious. A text yes to 85763 or no. And from a landline, 25p a minute to actually make your vote as to whether it should be allowed or not. This is how crazy it was. This was April 21st, 2007. So
it's not that long ago, is it?
You say you didn't eat properly or sleep properly for 3 days before the game and your preparation was affected. At any point did you think, oh God, I wish I hadn't said yes, or maybe I might not do this after all?
Oh, I'd love for it to have just gone away at that time. It would have been amazing. But no, it's one of those, I had a mindset where I was very, very strong in my mind. I was living on my own. I was single at the time. So I just had myself for company and my nonstop phone calls. And I just thought, you've just got to be calm. You've just got to behave the right way. I'd always tried to do things the right way. I started my career right from the very bottom of hospital radio, non-league, local radio, etc. So I tried to take every step along the way that was the right one. I wanted to do my job properly. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a trained journalist. I wanted not to cut any corners, and I wanted to cover all bases. And I didn't let that stop that week. Yes, it would have been great had that never happened, but I was in a situation whereby I just had to make the most of that situation, get through it the best I could. And the thing I found the hardest was I felt that I couldn't actually do the commentary as well as I'd like to have done because of the lack of prep time, because of all that. But equally, I couldn't change that at that time. So I just got on with it. And yeah, it was all right. It was okay. It wasn't amazing. But the weirdest thing was on the Monday morning, and I found the article the other day on the back page of a national newspaper, had basically speculated and suggested very strongly that I hadn't actually done the commentary myself. It had been so bad that I'd had to go back to Television Centre afterwards, write a script for 8.5 minutes and read this script into a microphone, which is what they used on Match of the Day. Now, somewhere down the piece, it said the BBC completely denies this and says she went and interviewed the managers and then went home again, which is literally what I did. So it was simply not true. But I found after getting through all that and then being front page of the Sunday Times the next day, which I'd forgotten again until the other day, and then picking up the paper on a Monday morning because I had them delivered to my flat, and just picking that up and thinking, what the blazes? This is simply not true. And I'll tell you what, if I'd have redubbed it, it'd have been better than that.
did it make you, because I guess when you're doing the job, you are not spending every second thinking about sexism in football or women's role in football or anything like that. But did it surprise you and make you think, wow, it is more endemic than I ever thought it was?
Yeah, because I hadn't really, I mean, you go through life not thinking about what gender you are, do you? You just be yourself and crack on. And so I was just a girl who was obsessed with sport, obsessed with football, and really wanted to be a sports broadcaster. So I did everything I could to be the best that I could personally be. So suddenly you're thrust into a commentary box at Bradford Park Avenue for my first reporting game, enclosed one. I'm thinking, oh gosh, I look very different to the guys that are in this box. And suddenly you feel very different. And every game you go to, and you're asking players for formations and stuff, and they're looking at you like you're an alien. You suddenly realise that, okay, there aren't many women doing this job, or back then there weren't. So it does add a bigger layer of scrutiny. But most of the time I don't think, oh gosh, I'm a female doing this. Am I going to be treated differently? And it's so much better now. It's so much easier now. I think with the advent of Twitter, people follow you. They see what you're doing. You're interviewing people. They know your views on stuff. And they know that, as you mentioned earlier on, had you just been plucked from the street and thrown into the commentary box, I think a lot of people at the time thought that was the case. Whereas now people can see your footprint on social media and on the internet and read about your background and understand your journey. I don't like that word, but know that you've worked your way up from scratch. Whereas back then, if anybody wanted to know, right, who is this woman, then they wouldn't have known, because I'd never done the interviews. I kept myself very low key. I didn't do a single interview in that whole time, despite hundreds of requests, because I just wanted to be like any other commentator. I didn't want to be treated any differently. I didn't want to be a novelty. I didn't want to be a celebrity. I didn't want to be on quiz shows. And I turned down a lot of money to do those at the time, because it wasn't about money. It was about being a journalist and being a commentator. So I just tried to fit in all these years. And now I'm much more relaxed about it, much more relaxed. And it's a relief to just be yourself. It sounds crazy, doesn't it? You can just relax and be yourself and work hard. And if people judge you adversely, well, there's nothing you can do about it, because you're just being yourself and doing your best.
I read that, I think when you did your first BBC Sport news update or new, you know, bulletin, that you were getting like hand-delivered letters telling you to watch yourself. I mean, that is pretty brutal, that.
Yeah, I've still got that letter. I say that letter, I've only kept one of them. They were weekly for a while. When I was 6 months pregnant with my first child and I was doing BBC News Channel when it was in TV Centre in London, so just across the desk from Five Live, I was just doing, you know, a few shifts there. And every week I'd come in early as the morning when it's pitch black and go to my pigeonhole, which I shared with lovely Sean Fletcher, now at Good Morning Britain. And I would get these handwritten letters and brown envelope, and they looked as though they were written with a person's unfavoured hand. Obviously, no return address on there. And the first one I got, I was like, what is this? What is this? And it was hideous. It was very personal. It was disgusting. And they became more and more threatening. Every week I'd go in and open one of these brown envelopes, and it was saying, watch your back. You have enemies. You're heading for a nasty fall. And being 6 months pregnant and coming in pitch black in the early hours, one time I remember it really got to me and I burst into tears. I think it's the only time I've actually cried in this industry, actually, in 18, 19 years, whatever it is. And then the BBC brought, you know, some compliance department in, I think it was, and said, do you want to go to the police? But if you do, it might get public. And I didn't want it to get public. So they just started taking my mail off me. But unfortunately, that sort of thing can happen.
Do you get any grief, or the same level of grief, from the darts lot?
No, they're brilliant. No, not at all. No, gosh, go to the darts. It's like a big party. It's so much fun. We go to the likes of Minehead, Butlins and Minehead, with 5,000 fans. Or we did. I hope we'll be able to do that again. But no, the darts viewers have been great. And I came into it as an outsider and just love it. The team we work with at ITV are absolutely brilliant. So much fun. Loads of laughs. Come up with all sorts of ideas for interviews and what have you, and the things we're going to talk about. But I mean, it's a similar job in terms of you're asking questions that you think are relevant to the audience, and you're going to entertain them and put on the best show that you can. And journalism comes into that to an extent, but it is a different audience. And I don't think I've had any stick from them, touch wood. There's plenty of time for that. But most of football fans are absolutely fine as well. It's only the odd one. I mean, it really isn't a part of my everyday life, abuse and what have you. It's really, really not like that anymore. Times have changed so much, and there are so many good broadcasters, so many good writers, not enough writers, by the way, but there are more, and so it is a different, changing landscape, thank goodness.
How pleased were you to get the Sunday Supplement gig?
Oh, it was amazing. It was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I literally celebrated because I hadn't seen it coming at all. I had no idea Neil Ashton was leaving. I'd filled in for him when he went to Kosovo in the middle of November because he was covering England. And I guess it was right place, right time that I'd done that show. Absolutely loved it because I love asking questions. Absolutely love it. And yeah, so I saw on Twitter that on the Thursday that he was leaving, Sunday was his last one, and suddenly I was asked to take over. And I went, yes, please. Absolutely brilliant. I love it. Despite the late Saturday nights, early mornings, Sundays, absolutely love it. It's right up my street, that show.
I sort of feel it's like a sensible version of this pod.
Well, it's great because the guests you've got on in the studio have all spoken to multiple people at different clubs that week. Chief execs, players, what have you, agents, they've all got good contacts in different areas of the game. So you're bringing all that together on a Sunday morning and finding out not just their opinion, but you're, by nature of it, finding out the opinions of all these different people within the game and drawing the different stories out. And waking up on a Sunday morning, getting into the studio or the production room at 6 o'clock and just spending lots of quiet time reading through all the columnists' views that day. It's a real pleasure because, you know, with young children, you don't often get to just sit and read papers for hours. So it's a joy.
The last few Sunday Supplements, it's been Jeff Shreves doing it and not you. Why is that?
I did the last one in the studio a few weeks ago, and then we found out that they weren't going to have guests in, and so it was off for the foreseeable. So it was off for a month or so. But now, because of the situation that we're all in, they've decided to use presenters who are there and on contract. I'm not on contract. So, yeah. So I guess we'll have to wait for football to resume.
Hmm. That's something you and Max have in common. No contract with Sky.
Yeah, it's a great time to be a football freelancer, let me tell you, when all your work and all the speaking gigs that were in my diary for months on end to pay the mortgage, all wiped away, apart from a Monday podcast. Yeah, it's all gone.
Do you know what? You get free Sky, or I got free Sky when I was at Sky.
Did you?
And then, yeah, I did. And they didn't get rid of it for ages. Just before the lockdown, I got a letter going. So for the last sort of 2-3 years, every time I switch my telly on, I'd be like, has it gone? No, it's still here. Then I got a letter saying, we're getting rid of your free Sky. So I texted one of the bosses at Sky saying, come on, 10 years service, surely you can pull a few strings. Absolute silence. Two blue ticks.
Two blue ticks. No, I've never had free Sky, but
No, I mean, that was the biggest part of it. Anyway, we've got some questions from listeners, Jackie, before we end this part. David says, who would you like to play darts against?
Fallon Sherrick, definitely. She's brilliant. Loads of them. I quite like to play against, I mean, obviously, games wouldn't last very long, but Gerwyn Price is a big personality, Welshman, double Grand Slam champion. He's quite something. So yeah, probably Gerwyn Price, but Fallon Sherrick, love her.
Chris asks, and I don't know why, so there may be context to this, do you like oats?
I do. I have them every morning. Do you know what? I love my porridge. Do my bike ride 6 till 7, come home, have my porridge with almond butter. Have you ever tried crunchy almond butter instead of peanut butter? It's like peanut butter, but it's a little bit runnier and it tastes of almonds. It's made of almonds. That's probably why.
I see now, producer Jonathan's pointed out that your surname is Oatley. I could possibly have worked.
Oh, you didn't work that one out. Oh, no. Oh, you are kidding me.
I mean, that might be the stupidest I've ever been, but, you know, keep it in. Barnaby, as a George Mendes FC fan, how much is Jackie looking forward to Mourinho's inevitable sinking of the club at the end of its current cycle of success?
Oh, that's just such a lovely tweet. Hey, oh, Barnaby, you're just so lovely. Thanks for that. Oh, no. I mean, it is a weird situation, isn't it? Because you couldn't have imagined a club improving quite as quickly as they have and playing beautiful football that they play. Mm. They are genuinely just stunning to watch and seem to be a really good bunch of lads as well. You don't have any of these sort of issues with bad apples and what have you. But the players have been collected assiduously, and that's one of the reasons they've gone on to do so well so quickly, is because of the type of characters, led of course by Connor Cody, who I think everybody would love to have that kind of character in their team. But there are probably quite a few Wolves fans who are thinking, how long is this going to last? And the fear, of course, is Nuno leaving, which is just not worth contemplating for a lot of fans.
Nag says, if you had to pick one for your Wolves starting 11, would you choose Raul Jimenez or Steve Ball?
Steve Ball, mate. Because he's a tatter lad, you know. It's just impossible. How do you compare Steve Ball to Raul Jimenez? Bully 306 goals for Wolves, dragged them up from fourth division to the third, to the championship, played for England when he was just coming out of the third division. It's just an incredible story. So emotionally, every Wolves fan from that era would gravitate towards Stevie Ball. And he was just phenomenal, went to Italia 90, of course. But Raul Jimenez is just a different breed. He's more in the Harry Kane kind of mould, isn't he, of being able to hold the ball up and bring others into play. He's finishing. Lovely lad as well. Really, really nice lad. But it's comparing donuts to jelly babies.
Jackie, thanks so much for coming on and telling us your life story. We appreciate it. Will you hang around for part three?
Yeah, let's do that. It keeps me away from homeschooling. I get an extra few minutes off.
All right, Archie Rintup will join us as well. We'll talk about the Bundesliga and round up any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Before we crack on with this part, just to let you know that our watch-along this weekend is the Champions League final from 2005, Liverpool versus AC Milan. Me, Barry and Greg Bukowski will be watching that from 4 o'clock. We're going to record the pod straight after as well. So if you have any questions, get them in on Twitter before Saturday at around 6 p.m. That'd be great. So the Bundesliga is set to return on the 16th of May next Saturday as the German government relaxed their lockdown conditions. Joining us, Archie Rintut, who's over in Germany in his house, not in Lukas Podolski's kebab shop. Archie, how are you doing?
Very well, Max. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm all right. Now, you're further on with lockdown. They've relaxed things. I saw you filming outside Lukas's kebab shop and getting a reply from Lukas Podolski, which is a big moment for the podcast.
I mean, huge, huge. I couldn't have anticipated a response from the big man himself. And, you know, I'm glad to see as well that business was booming for him because, you know, in these difficult times, and given the fact that's our one gimmick, we have to still be able to rely on that gimmick. So I thank God for that, to be honest.
Now, Bundesliga is set to return then. Is everyone happy about football coming back?
Depends who you ask. If you're asking the players, I think there's a 10% who are a little bit anxious towards this. You saw an interview with Birger Verstraete, a defensive midfielder for Cologne, who gave an interview to Belgian TV saying that actually he was worried because of his girlfriend, who is a problem case right now, or is extra sensitive towards catching any sort of corona. And the club then doubled down on that and said, he was translated poorly. That didn't happen, when actually there was a native speaker who translated it and he was translated fine. So I think that shows some of the anxiety, but I think that the majority of players are going to be happy to get playing again in some form. Whether the fans are happy here, I think mixed opinions, because are you measuring the ultras? Because I don't think the ultras want to play, but then again, the ultras are having their power stripped away from them bit by bit, whether it's by video evidence, VAR, in the past few years, and how the most important thing is not being the fan in the stadium. The fan on TV back home has greater power because he sees everything back home and what's going on with VAR. You have less of an idea if you're in the stadium, which is bizarre. But now, what with fans being rated as unimportant, I mean, let's face it, the Bundesliga is saying that they need to keep going for these contracts or else clubs will go bust. like Schalke, for example. So what happened was the Bundesliga said to the clubs, okay, financially, who can cope through this? And early on, clubs like Schalke were like, we're going to struggle. And it's not even kind of Schalke's fault, because it's just more to do with how they loaded their payments of TV money through the season. So to get back to the original point, I've done a bit of an inception there, just kind of gone deeper and deeper and deeper. So if you look at the way that the ultras are seeing this, for them, it's best that football continues in this form, because otherwise, if football was to collapse, you'd have a Wild West where just even richer people would come in and the mainstream would take what's ever on offer, and that completely rules out the ultras. But I think on the whole, this is seen as the only real scenario that can go ahead. And Germany is prepared for it as well, because they have the capacity in terms of hospitals not being overrun that I don't think the UK has right now to be able to do this. And their rate of COVID deaths has been 7,000, which I think is some 23,000 less than the UK, which shows you, I don't want to say how well they're dealing with it, but because that doesn't feel like the right choice of words in terms of that. But I'm sure you get the point I'm trying to make here, which is that they've managed to limit the impact a little bit more.
Are all the Bundesliga clubs then happy? Is there a sort of universal happiness to go out and play them from the club's point of view?
Mainz and Werder Bremen are not happy at having, by the looks of it, so there's a DFL meeting today, Thursday, where they will decide the exact dates of getting back. Mainz and Werder Bremen, as their federal states also tried to do in the meetings with Angela Merkel, were trying to push back for a later start date because they've not been in team training, whereas the bigger clubs have been saying, well, tough, we need to get on with this because contracts, everything needs to finish before June 30th. So on the one hand, no, not happy in terms of those kind of details. But I think the difference to make between the Premier League and the Bundesliga, it's almost like, say you've got a lot of kids and you've got a bunch of toys, right? The Bundesliga is say, like, everyone appreciates that to keep the toys, they need to sit down and do this, and they've got to that point. And it doesn't matter who plays with what toys. Whereas the Premier League's, you've got lots of clubs who are like, well, I want that toy. And it's like, yeah, but we might have no toys. It's like, yeah, but I want that toy. And that's kind of the difference, is that at least the Bundesliga is prepared to kind of, the clubs are like, well, we need to save all of us here. Doesn't matter kind of what happens with positions and that can come later. And Mainz and Werder Bremen have begrudgingly accepted that too. But I think in the Premier League, there's a lot more at stake on a financial level, because there's a lot more debt and I would say financial mismanagement in the Premier League. You see it every year where I don't think it's necessarily like the three worst teams. It's the three worst run teams a lot of the time who go down, which leaves a lot of teams still there, such as, let's say, West Ham, who are not particularly well run, but survive by the virtue of there being three worse teams than them. So, yeah. In terms of the Bundesliga, I would say that they're quite, like, not universal happiness, but they've at least got the ball rolling in that sense.
Are you suggesting, Archie, that there's perhaps a little less self-interest in German football than there is in this country, because we are riddled with it over here, possibly because there's so much more money at stake?
Yeah, you've managed to succinctly put what I was bumbling along in 90 seconds very well. Yeah, I do think there's a lot. I think there's a lot less self-interest, but it manifests itself in different ways. You've got Bayern Munich, who are still kind of talking about transfers and getting these contracts done, which kind of, I don't know how right that feels right now, that kind of celebrating getting a cut price for Leroy Sané. I guess they've not been celebrating, but that's how it kind of comes across in the media anyway. But yeah, I think there's just differing levels of self-interest over here. It's just that it's not shown quite as brazenly as it is in the Premier League.
And sorry to talk transfer fees at a time like this when there are sort of bigger issues at play, but still these things are being discussed. Jadon Sancho had been strongly linked with a move back to the Premier League before coronavirus. Where do you reckon that potential move stands now?
I think if the money was there, Dortmund would still very much take it. But there's been talk of that move and Kai Havertz, who is meant to go to Bayern Munich for very large money. Bayer Leverkusen said to only be accepting something in the region of 100 million before all this happened. That said, Leverkusen said they wanted to keep Havertz for another year because they thought he could progress. But I think all transfers right now of that kind of figure are going to be on the ropes. And I would say Sancho included. And I don't think it would actually be a bad thing for his career either, were he to stay another year. I think it can be... Things can accelerate so quickly for these young players that, you know what, he's in a team where he's really valued. And I think there's slightly less pressure for him doing this without the English frenzy, even though there's a lot of hype over him here. So, yeah, I wouldn't expect him to move this year now. But who knows who still has money? I think that's going to be the biggest question.
Barry, I'm not sure how comfortable I feel with Jackie asking these sensible, insightful questions quite so well.
You're thinking because she's lost all her other gigs, she might be after yours?
I'm going to have to check my contract when the pod finishes. The DFL announced that they've had these 10 positive cases after testing 1,724 players and staff at its 36 first and second division clubs. What happens with the 10 who've tested positive? Are their clubs quarantining?
So the quarantining thing has changed in that, you remember at the start it was, right, you've got to quarantine 2 weeks completely. We check you before and we check you after. Such is the way that the Bundesliga want to make this work. There's now testing every 2 or 3 days for everybody involved. So there's still individual quarantining within that, but it doesn't mean that that person will have to quarantine for 14 days straight. It will be dependent on when they do have the virus or when it does go away. We're actually awaiting the next tranche of results from this because there were more tests done earlier this week in line with this every 2 or 3 days, kind of twice or three times a week, that they want to do the testing. And to do this, they need a capacity of 25,000 tests, I believe, to continue doing it at this rate. And just to give you an idea, the capacity for testing in Germany per day is around 140,000. So Germany can cope with this, as we said, unlike, I would say, other countries, because they've got the infrastructure.
La Liga teams are back in training this week. Serie A teams also getting back to individual training sessions. The Premier League are meeting on Monday, where a vote is set to take place after some restrictions are expected to be relaxed in the UK this weekend. Aston Villa have joined Brighton in coming out against neutral grounds. The CEO, Christian Perslow, said, "When you say to any club, we want you to agree to a bunch of rule changes that may make it more likely that you get relegated, they're not thinking about TV money. They're thinking, my goodness, am I going to agree to something that results in me being relegated and losing £200 million? In the Times today, Matt Lawton saying that almost every game will get its own slot for broadcasters. The intention is to stage 3 or 4 Premier League and Championship games every day at different kickoff times until the end of July. There are 92 Premier League games left to be played and 108 in the Championship. The Times understands the scheduling plan has already... has government support because it'll help keep people indoors and dissuade some fans from trying to gather at the neutral venues being used by their teams. My first thought, Barry, is if it does come back like that, we've got a lot of football to watch.
Yeah, and a lot of not very good football, I suspect, because the idea of watching top flight or championship games with no crowds doesn't appeal to me at all, I have to say. I totally get that the Premier League and the Championship and whatnot, they want to get back playing. But I really... I'm concerned that this is, in years to come, will be another one of those what the hell were they thinking incidents. As far as the Premier League is concerned, there's no coherent plan in place. There's no uniformity of purpose. And it's just panic and desperation-induced chaos, as far as I can see. So it will be interesting to see what comes out of this meeting on Monday. I see also the collective group of doctors for various Premier League clubs has submitted a list of 100 different concerns they have about the Premier League show getting back on the road. So I don't know what will happen.
Jackie, you're quite firmly in the pro column for wanting to get football back on.
Well, only when it's safe to do so. I mean, that's the key phrase everywhere, isn't it? But I think people who have a go at the Premier League and the various stakeholders for putting together this plan for football to potentially resume, I just don't understand why people are critical of it. You have to have that plan in place because it's not purely about money in the sense of people want to be greedy, people want to be super rich. It's about livelihoods. And there are so many more livelihoods at stake and well-being of individuals as well as a result of football coming back, way more than whether a player is going to continue to be able to earn 300 grand a week or not. There are so many other people who perhaps aren't being considered in this bigger picture who need football to come back when it's safe to do so. So you have to have all these different measures in place. So I think it's right what they've done to have these meetings, stakeholders, viewpoints, club doctors putting their 100 questions, what have you. Questions about liability, if something was to go wrong, if a player contracts COVID, the grandmother dies as a result. You know, there are so many different facets to it, but they have to plan. You can't not plan, because what happens if the government says, okay, we're way past the peak, we've got this under control to manageable levels compared to other illnesses, etc., and you're ready to go. And then the Premier League go, oh, hang on, we weren't expecting that. Oh, hang on, we need to get players back from Portugal and Germany or wherever they've been with their families. So they have to do it. But of course, they do have to make sure that they've limited the prospect of something going totally wrong. And the main concern really is that they go through all these hoops. They spend tens of thousands on testing for players, coaches, physios, everybody, journalists, etc. They'll have to do to let everybody in the ground. And then somebody from one of the teams test positive. And I've been thinking about this. I was thinking about it on my bike this morning, that what happens if somebody tests positive and everybody around them knows that if that becomes public knowledge, that potentially all this could stop again. Is there going to be the temptation to suppress the negative news? I believe from what I've read somewhere that the test results will go to the Premier League. So you would think not. You would think that it would be an open, honest situation. But the temptation must be, we've got to get these games played. We've got to get our TV money. We've got to get to the end of the season and just hope that something seriously bad doesn't happen along the way, because it could all fall apart again.
Well, I agree with pretty much everything you say there, Jackie. But the key phrase that you mentioned is when it is safe to do so. And it's the government taking scientific advice who decide when it's safe to do so, and they have proved over the course of recent weeks that they cannot be trusted. And I have every confidence they will say it is safe to go back playing football when perhaps it might not be safe at all.
But also, what's the level of safety? I mean, it's impossible to say that during the course of a season somebody's not going to test positive for flu or something. And I'm not saying COVID's not more serious than flu. Of course, it's a pandemic. We understand exactly how serious it is. And probably we all may be aware of somebody who's sadly passed away. I know a friend's dad's passed away from it. It's not something to remotely take lightly. It's more a case of the balance. I think this is the key thing here. It's not writing off it, well, you know, it's okay now, we're past the peak, let's crack on because we need to make money out of football. It's about the balance of people's livelihoods, clubs falling away. This is not all about the Premier League. It's about the Football League. It's about non-league. It's about women's football as well, which doesn't get as much of a mention anywhere near as much. It's about, will we have clubs to go back to? So if the balance of probability is that, yes, this is, it's better to continue than it is to stop it for several months, then that has to be seriously considered. It's a very, very fine balancing act.
A few interesting anniversaries today. It's Lasagna Day today, the day that West Ham beat Spurs in 2006 after Spurs had a dodgy lasagna and their players were throwing up all over the pitch. A year ago yesterday, Vincent Kompany scored that ridiculous goal against Leicester, which basically won Man City the league. A year ago today, Liverpool beat Barcelona 4-0. And a year ago tomorrow, Lucas Moura in Amsterdam with that hat-trick. Like a totally breathless 3 days of football. those moments remind you of why we love it and why actually it'd be quite nice to have some to watch again. And Andreas Iniesta spent part of Wednesday having a video chat with two 10-year-olds. It was the 11th anniversary of the late winner he scored against Chelsea in the Champions League semi-finals. 9 months after that, there was a spike in the birth rate in Catalonia. These two children were among those thought to have been conceived shortly after that goal. Right, that'll do for today. Jackie, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciated it. Enjoyed your life story. Thank you, Archie Rintutz. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry. Now, Barry's lyrics to finish the pod. You can choose, Jackie. Let It Go from Frozen. Jump Around House of Pain. It's the End of the World as We Know It, R.E.M. or 500 Miles by The Proclaimers.
R.E.M., definitely, please.
I thought you'd go for Let It Go, but...
Yeah, I was hoping for Let It Go.
It would have been nice and short for you, but no, it's probably a bit more complex.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and aeroplanes, and Lenny Bruce is not afraid. Eye of a hurricane, listen to yourself churn. World serves its own needs, don't misserve your own needs. Speed it up a notch, speed, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with a fear of height, down height. Wire in a fire represent the seven games, and a government for hire and a combat site. Left her, wasn't coming in a hurry, with the furies breathing down your neck. Team by team, reporters baffled, Trump tethered, cropped. Look at that low plane, fine then. Uh-oh, overflow, population, common group. But it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs, listen to your heart bleed. Tell me with the rapture and the reverent in the right. You vitriolic, patriotic, slam fight, bright light, feeling pretty psyched. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.